entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Hey, welcome into Sunday morning. It's the best of Downtown on this 11th day of February. Brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Rich Kimble, Kerry Haskell here with you, our weekly look back at some of our favorite conversations from the past week. A perhaps even more eclectic than usual roundtable discussion this morning as we talk everything from the influence of Russian bots to the Red Sox lackluster offseason, mistaking competence for greatness, the blizzard of 78, and how to prepare for death. Well, there you go. I'm sure, Kerry, there's some thread that connects them all together, but I'm not sure I want to think about it too deeply.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what it would be, but there is. Look for it and get back to us.
Yeah, exactly. That's all coming up here on your Sunday morning Best of Downtown, brought to you as always by our friends at Quirk Motor City Used Vehicle Center, with locations in Augusta, Bangor, Belfast, and Portland. It's your car. Find it at quirkauto.com. Well, we did indeed have a fascinating conversation this week with information warfare expert Molly McHugh, who wrote a blockbuster piece on Politico about how Russian bots, with the help of right-wing media influencers and human beings who sort of acted like bots, managed to spread the Release the Memo hashtag so often, so frequently, and in such a targeted manner that it convinced the House to release that Devin Nunes memo. What implications that has for us, and why both sides are trying to manipulate us. Here's our conversation with Molly McHugh on the Best of Downtown. Let's start right at the top. Release the memo. That hashtag and that campaign was essentially an 11-day case study in what's known as computational propaganda.
That's right, and I think that it was a really interesting one in this particular period of time in sort of the American information landscape, because there's been a lot of discussion about sort of Russian bots and Russian social media influence, and there's been a lot of commentary, obviously, about what's happening from sort of the right side as well. And this was a really interesting fusion of all of these things. It was a component that was human, there was a component that was bot, there was a component that was Russian, and there was definitely components that were real, authentic American, sort of underlaid by this amplification and automation of promoting content in very manipulative and coercive ways, targeting members of Congress and other influencers to try to push this agenda. And kind of the combination of all of those different things was really interesting and very quick and very effective.
Now, I'm sure there are people out there, although we have a very smart audience, but there are people who don't understand what bots are and how they work. Can you give a brief tutorial, particularly on Twitter and on social media, of how those bots work and what their purpose is?
Let me climb up out of my nerd hole a little bit and give a little more detail. There's algorithms that underlay all social media in terms of how it decides what is important. So, you know, what is the trending news? What is a trending topic? How does Facebook or Twitter or anything else put the article, tweet, post, video in front of you that it is giving you as recommended content? All of that is determined by algorithms, and there are ways to kind of game those algorithms to make your thing trend, whatever your thing might be. You can also pay for that, but you can also do it without pay. And bots are used kind of in that category. So you create an automated account on these things that repost or post or retweet content automatically without needing anybody attached to it. They also can reply to things and sort of automate comments, and that's where you get some nasty kind of trolling at some point as well. So they're sort of bots, which are basically fully automated accounts. Sometimes they're backed by AI or sort of machine learning techniques that make them smarter and look more like people. There's real humans who use software and applications that allow you to sort of automate part of your feed, so it will automatically retweet certain content that comes into your Twitter feed and things like that, and sort of refer to those accounts kind of as cyborgs because they're kind of half human and half automated. And there's sort of other pieces of that as well, but the sort of the automation aspect, particularly on Twitter, which is very vulnerable to this, because it allows you to do the automatic posting and retweeting and sort of replies and follow back kind of things, has become very aggressive to the point where you don't even know what's real on Twitter anymore or not. You know, the president has almost 50 million followers. At the inauguration, he had about 23 million. I'm sure he has had a significant increase, but probably 23 million of the accounts that follow him are some form of bot. And if you think about that kind of amplification potential, it's pretty incredible.
Well, you've talked about this being a fusion of elements, the bots, the real people, the media amplifiers. I want to focus on those real people. And these are, generally speaking, folks who are willing to be, I guess, for lack of a better term, human bots, in that they will go out and tweet and retweet often dozens of times a day.
It was one of the most interesting aspects of doing the research on this particular hashtag, as we sort of started with the assumption that, yes, there's authentic Republican promoters involved in this, but there's also going to be a lot of automation. And the combination of those two things was the part that was the most interesting. There are a significant number of accounts that have been, particularly since sort of the 2016 election cycle, that are real Trump supporters, that are real Americans, as far as you can determine, and sometimes it's very sophisticated the way that fake accounts are set up. But the ones that were mentioned in the Politico piece were ones that we verified as actual humans when we called them humans. They have sort of, there's these long lists of other accounts that you're supposed to follow and promote, so it creates these kind of very effective amplification and feedback chambers. But you'll see them both post lists of accounts to follow and sort of create these bigger connections and networks within social media. But you'll see them telling people what to do. And some of this is also, like, you don't see it. It's kind of in chat rooms and happening secretly as well. But in many of these cases, a lot of the amplifiers will say, hey, everybody, we need release the memo to trend. Keep tweeting it. And you see these very aggressive campaigns, which are backed by automation and bots, to push these hashtags to make them sort of explode. And in the interesting sort of first 12 hours of this particular hashtag, they were very much, there's sort of the automation, the targeting, and the organization that are really critical. The organization was the hashtag, sort of getting all of the discussion of this memo under one hashtag, so all the content was coming up under the same search, basically. The automation we've discussed, the targeting was sort of tagging tweets to specific congressmen and far-right amplifiers who could make this more of a thing and who needed to vote to actually release the memo. So within the 11-day time period, after everybody was sort of captured by this hashtag, the Republican members of the House Intelligence Committee who voted to release the memo were targeted hundreds of thousands of times by messages on social media urging them to release the memo. How much of that was real versus not is hard to know. But if you compare that to the kind of volume that a normal congressional or Senate office would get from phone calls or emails or letters from constituents, this vastly outweighs it and creates the perception, a very manipulative perception, that this is something with public support.
Well, and that's the frightening thing about this, is that the congressmen, and some of them perhaps not as media savvy as the average American voter or consumer of information, can easily be led to believe that there's some sort of national groundswell driving this, when in fact that may not be the case at all.
That's exactly right. And I think these things work better when they're reinforcing bias. It's called confirmation bias, as opposed to trying to create something completely new. But I think it's sort of the reinforcing bias plus that faux sense of pressure that were the two really effective things in this campaign. The congressmen that were being targeted were ones that were already extremely supportive of the president, extremely dismissive of the Russia investigation, already talking about the memo, but none of them were using the release the memo hashtag. And that was the really interesting part, was like getting them sort of captured behind the campaign and driving it forward made it a lot more powerful over the week plus that it was discussed, and sort of drove the entire national discussion. And that was the part that was interesting, because the point of computational propaganda is not just fake news, and I really hate the term fake news because I find it very dismissive of what is actually happening. But the point of computational propaganda is to manipulate perception and to change the way that people are thinking and making decisions for the point of ultimately changing behavior. And that is what we have really not been discussing as much as we should have been since the 2016 election when we're talking about all of these issues. It's not just about changing our news feeds. It's about changing the way that we make decisions about our country, about our tolerance of certain things. That's a really messy rabbit hole to go down. But if you put it strictly in digital marketing terms, you know, can something make you buy a pair of shoes? You would say absolutely. But when it comes to can something make you buy a politician, we don't want to have that conversation. And we really need to.
We're talking with Molly McHugh here on Downtown. So we're talking about the right, and obviously they've become quite adept at this, but there are also bots that do their work on the other side, including what are known as Bernie bots.
Yeah, I like the phrase Bernie bots. But there was a really aggressive sort of the same type of architecture put in place on the left in the same time period. So sort of starting summer 2015, moving forward, it sort of became captured behind the Bernie brand. This has nothing to do with Bernie Sanders. I'm sure he had nothing to do with this, but that was the sentiment that was being sort of provoked on that side, was dividing the Democratic Party, anti-Clinton narrative, consistent with what the Russians were doing on the right as well. But this very anti-establishment, burn it all down sense of government. And part of that was, there's been really good documentation on this one aspect of it, which was fake Antifa accounts, so these sort of anti-fascist movement accounts. But there are legitimate U.S. supporters of this. There are real groups doing work in that space who organize protests and demonstrations. But there had been hundreds of completely fake local Antifa accounts. So it would be, you know, Jacksonville Antifa something. But hundreds of fake accounts that were set up to sort of mobilize discussion around these topics. And all of that is still sort of hanging around out there. And it becomes particularly active on certain topics. For example, after the Charlottesville neo-Nazi march, the Bernie bots were super active, attacking anybody who in any way sort of implied that these people were foreign connected in any way, shape, or form, and not just authentically bad Americans, which was a really interesting sort of narrative space for them to be in. But I think this is the part that, again, we need to sort of pay attention to. It's not, everybody wants to say it's Russians or it's crazy Trump supporters or it's crazy whatever, but it is information architecture that is constructed for the purpose of basically radicalization and division. Some foreign, some domestic, and honestly, that's the part that is extremely troubling to me. If you can pin it all on a foreign adversary, wouldn't that be nice? But these techniques are being emulated by people inside the United States because they're really effective, and our social media companies are allowing it to happen, and our lawmakers don't really know how to ask the right questions to fix it. And that leaves us sort of exposed and all of us sort of on the hook for learning how to construct our own psychological and information defense, which is kind of a crappy position to be in.
You mentioned the social media companies. Is there any incentive or is it going to have to come from the regulational incentive for them to fight the bots from their end? I mean, they should be able to do something to control the proliferation, I would think.
They absolutely can. There are, at the very least, the accounts that are super obvious bots, you know, retweeting only completely copied content from other botnets, they could be shut down. The problem is these were sort of initially invented as, by who is an interesting question that I hope someone will pursue at some point, but they were sort of invented as, again, part of marketing. And for Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and other things, this is a problem because people who have been paying to advertise on their platforms, which is where the vast majority of their sort of incoming wealth comes from, have been paying for, we have, you know, 4 billion users and this many of them are here and this many of them are there, and that's how many people have seen your ad. Well, what if 60% of those aren't real? Mm-hmm. And then people get really angry about that, and nobody wants to have that discussion. And Twitter in particular does not seem motivated to shut down all these fake accounts because it would very much change their financial models. You've heard a lot of discussion in the last year that some of the tech companies, granted not the leaders, but the lawyers, were up on the Hill in the Congress testifying about some of these questions. They were very cautious to reply, of course we'll be willing to help in all of your investigations, not to volunteer to do anything on their own. And I think that's the line they're going to continue to take until they are forced to change what they're doing. And that is not going to be either somebody creates something separate and everybody migrates off these platforms, or these guys clean up their acts and admit that they have created an extremely sophisticated platform for propaganda and screwing with people's heads, which may not have been their intention, but that is now how it's being used, and not just here, in a lot of countries.
So we've got about a minute left, Molly. So as individuals, what can we do, first of all, to be more educated consumers of what we see on these social media platforms, and I suppose to also avoid being an unwitting tool of these bots?
I think that's a huge part of it. Understanding who you're talking to, what you're reading, sort of being careful about your personal hygiene on social media is important. But the other problem of the aspect of what's happening, in, especially in Twitter, is it's creating incentive for everybody to do exactly the same thing. And Democrats right now in particular believe that the right has a huge advantage in this space, which they seem to have for sure, and want to learn how to emulate it because this is the option that social media companies are giving you. And I think we all need to be cautious about what this is doing to our information space. But understanding when one of these crazy conspiracy theory-like things comes out of nowhere, starts trending from a bunch of accounts nobody knows, that may be something you need to question. If it's left or right, it could be a pro-Democrat or pro-Republican narrative, but to sort of look at narrative and purpose. What is the purpose of this story? Not just is it true or what is it? And then you sort of understand a little more clearly the environment into which you wade. But it is not simple.
Information warfare strategist Molly McHugh here on the Best of Downtown. When we come back, we'll lighten it up a bit, talk with her friend writer Colin Fleming. It's Downtown on Z62 Retro Radio.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
It may not be prime biking season, but it's always a good time to make sure your cycle is in great shape. And there's only one place to go to do that. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. They offer outstanding service and a huge stock. Make sure you like them on Facebook to get updates, shop in person or online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With the network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
It's not always whether you win or lose, but who you've got on your team. The Emily Ellis team at Next Home Experience wants you to enjoy the best team chemistry in real estate. If you're looking to buy, sell, rent, or build in the Bangor area, make Emily Ellis's All-Star Squad your go-to team. Responsive and experienced, the Emily Ellis team will make your real estate quest as smooth as possible. Linda, Jen, Callie, and Emily will listen and prepare your game plan. The Emily Ellis team at 57 Washington Street in Bangor, shooting for your goals.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain.
Oh, little Jerry Lee gets you going here on a Sunday morning, Best of Downtown. Guests of the show come your way on the G&M Family Market phone line there on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden, open today and every day, 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. Every Tuesday, we talk with writer Colin Fleming. A wide-ranging discussion this week with Colin, including the notion that mere competence, rare in today's world, is sometimes confused with greatness.
I think it's more so the notion that competence is the new sort of apex of achievement. Competence has become something that replaces talent, which seems to be on its way out for a host of reasons, I think. And so what ends up happening is it's almost like manna when we meet someone who basically is not completely rubbish at their job. And a lot of my job involves writing people, most of whom will ignore me, but I probably send out about 10,000 words worth of stuff a week. And I've noticed you can even track it over 6 months. If the person that used to maybe get back to you in 3 weeks, it's 3 months now, it's 5 months. You can actually feel it at that kind of like quotidian, day in, day out level, where someone, if they just do their job, you just want to bow down and think, wow, thank you so much. What a great relief this oasis is.
Well, and why is that acceptable? We've talked about this in a sports sense, that Major League Baseball is a great example. There seem to be cities, franchises, ownership groups who are more than willing to write off even a shot at a championship. Why do people tolerate that?
It's like drugs. It's enabling, really, I think. I think a lot of people have so much panic and fear inside of them in terms of what they believe they should be and what they're fearful they are not. And so they have a kind of stage presentation of themselves that they put out there to the world. You'll notice if someone has any interest in anything, it can just be like, oh, on occasion, I like to go to a museum. They'll almost always preface the expression of that interest with a disclaimer. I know it's so nerdy, but like, dude, relax. It's okay to like interesting things. You don't just have to be about saying you're about the Netflix all the time. And I think what happens then is expectations become scaled back. And because no one polices the individual person, including the person themselves, if no one is complaining and the Facebook likes are rolling in, other people who also count on those likes, so the enablers enable the other enablers, well, the system just rolls on unchecked and we become desensitized, we become disconnected, and there's very little true connection between people and with people with themselves. And I think mediocrity then becomes something that's very non-threatening, whereas talent, let alone genius, terrifies these people.
We've talked about this before, too, and you write a lot. You are incredibly productive. Not everybody is productive, and part of that, too, is because of these diversions, the time sucks that are out there. And so I wonder if you think that which one is the chicken and which one is the egg? Are people less productive because these diversions are pulling them away, or do they seek those diversions to avoid attempting and perhaps failing at productivity?
The combo. Look, I'll have like a Saturday morning where I'll have something in the New York Times and I'll be on NPR. That'll be at the end of a week where I've been in Salon and Rolling Stone and Washington Post, whatever else. And what will happen to me then is 30 people would befriend me on Facebook and it will become harder for me to get work because people know about these things. Then the green beast rears its head. And that's not because someone necessarily hates me, although that's what it ends up looking like. They're dissatisfied with the fact that 10:30, they're still in bed. This guy's doing this. I don't want to hear about this. This is depressing to me. Oh, and he just walked 12 miles? This is irksome. I'll show him, so they don't have to actually say, you know what? I can get up. I can do some stuff. Maybe can't do some of that, but I can do my things. And other people maybe can't do those, and we can all kind of push each other a little bit. But that doesn't happen. It becomes really, again, that lack of accountability. No one is ever saying, hey, look, do this. You can do better. If people are not complaining and your check is coming in and you're sleeping in and your friends are, you know, being your friends basically in some kind of like fake way, but maybe you can't tell, you can lie to yourself, you're okay with it. And I think that's what happens. So when we have individuality now and we have effort and we have talent, which means nothing without effort, well, I think that person can become a pariah because that threatens that status quo.
Now, some people will look at play as the opposite of work, but I'm willing to bet that you believe differently, that play is a component of work and can make that work even better. Let's talk about play, real play, where you let yourself and let your imagination go.
I think a little child is oftentimes smarter than an adult. If you go out somewhere, say you're at the cafe, and the parent comes in with their kid, and the kid kind of, maybe there's another one, so one kid wanders off. That child views the world with a capacity for wonder, it will eventually be scrubbed out of that child, probably. But they're looking at things as though this is the most fascinating thing I've ever seen. If you're on like the subway here in Boston, you can see certain people, not many, they're not staring at their phone. They have an alertness to their eyes where they're, oh, what's that placard up there say? Oh, look at that woman who got on. She's wearing an interesting kind of shawl. You can see them engaged with the world. And I think that's in some ways what play is. I'll be walking down the street on one of my 10-mile walks. I'll find a pine cone. Well, I'm going to be Pele for a couple blocks. It's just like a silly thing. But it's that same kind of thinking that informs other thinking, like, all right, by the time we get to the end of the next block, I want you to come up with four characters, and we'll distribute them to different short stories in the future. But give me some characters. What are they doing? What are they doing right now if they're out there in the world? And that's just the way you had mentioned before that we don't allow kids to be bored. And I think that's true, too. It's just this constant bombardment where it's like, well, we're not going to let you think. And you're not going to let yourself think, and you again become, as with mediocrity, desensitized to everything around you.
40 years ago today was the start of the blizzard of 78. I have my own vivid memories from that time. But for you, this was in many ways a life-changing experience, even though you were what, all of 2 years old?
I was two, but there had been snow, and I had snow in my mind. I was very clear on what snow was, and I knew even then that that was a bit different. I remember being outside with my dad pulling me around in the sled, and these were mountains of snow. It reminded me of some of the scenes in like the Rankin-Bass Rudolph special, which I'm convinced that Radiohead lifted for their Kid A album cover. And I just thought, wow, this world is this visitation almost upon like our regular kind of samey world. And it just got me thinking, you'd see these crevasses and these huge boulders of ice and snow that the plows had pushed aside. And I just was thinking in terms of like, what happens if I'm being pulled along in my sled and I look inside one of these gaps and like, I see someone looking out at me. I can't even like talk right now, but I was kind of thinking like in terms of narrative. I was like, imagine if you had someone like that in the story. That's like, you're just out there hanging out in the snow. But it gave me this new sense of possibility. I imagine maybe, say, there was some boy slightly older than me who loved to play outside in the snow, but he didn't enjoy anything else but the snow. What would his life be like in the summer? And I would kind of imagine in my head, writing like I didn't know I was writing a story at the time, but I look back on it later, these characters. And again, what were they doing out there in the world, even though technically they didn't exist? And it's just that capacity for wonder that I think as adults we have to challenge ourselves to retain, or we're just not going to be an active presence, not just in our own lives, but in our relationships and what we might discover and how we might even hear music or look at a painting on the wall or watch a coach's decision not to play a guy in coverage. You know, it all sort of informs the way you experience and feel and think everything.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. He is over that Super Bowl completely. Don't listen to him when he talks that way. Let's talk about hockey. Last night, you were at the Bean Pod, a great annual Boston tradition.
Yes, I was at the Bean Pod. I was there late at the Bean Pod because the second game, which BU took, went to overtime. So it'll be BU versus Northeastern in the final. And mentioned talking about the blizzard, I was just, I was not at the Bean Pod in 1978. I didn't start going until really the late 90s, I think. But it's just this fantastic story of people who were at that Bean Pod in 78 with the blizzard. They got snowed in and they were at the Old Garden. I just was hearing that report. I thought, like, you know what? That would be a great start for a short story. Someone is there because of this circumstance and maybe in this confined area that they can't leave, right? Had no choice, basically. They are forced to confront, I don't know, some person from their past who happens to be there. And it just got me thinking again about snow and that blizzard and being 2 years old, and also how I would go into the room where my dad was watching hockey when I was a kid. And even before I could talk, I would hear these sounds of Fred Cusick. And I always associate him with hockey announcers. And it just made me think that words, they don't just have like their actual meaning. They have a kind of sonic resonance to them. So I'm sitting there watching last night and hearing all of that again through two you know, the sounds of the rink, the puck off the boards and everything. There's this kind of like concerto aspect to hockey that, you know what, I don't think I'd even have picked up on if I wasn't someone who retained that quality of play. I'd just be a guy sitting there, it's getting late, I hope someone scores soon.
My story of the Blizzard of 78 is not quite as exciting as being trapped at the Garden, but being voluntarily trapped. I was a young radio guy, and the Blizzard was coming, and I worked at a place across town that had two radio stations and a TV station, and the general manager said, we need volunteers to stay. And this was on a Tuesday, and he said, we're probably not going to get anybody back here until Thursday. So we need a couple people who can hang out and cover both radio stations and TV. And I gladly volunteered. It sounded like an adventure with another guy. And we stayed there and manned two radio stations, a TV station, which meant doing the 6 o'clock and the 11 o'clock TV news. He was a guy who had to shave about every 4 hours. And by the Wednesday night late news, looked like Lon Chaney Jr., ready to bay at the moon. But it was a great adventure, and I think it's one of the things that, if I didn't love radio already, that thrill of being in this situation when you knew everybody else was listening to radio somewhere because they couldn't get out of the house.
It sounds like a rosier version of, you ever see the Howard Hawks movie, The Thing from Another World?
Yes.
They're at like the science station, which is kind of like a radio station.
Yeah, oh yeah.
A little bit. There's like an antenna, and they like have walkie-talkies and everything, and they're just on site having this on-site adventure. And I mean, let's face it, a lot of the adventures you're going to have in life, such that you have, are not going to be like a Munson style or Melville going out on the Whaler. It's going to be like at your office or at a radio station like that during a snowstorm or at a hockey rink at night. And if you're not that little kid at the Starbucks who wants to kind of leave his mother's side and wander around a little bit, your life is going to be awfully tedious. In fact, I would say you're not even really going to be living. You're just going to be kind of like raising your hand like you do in attendance and say, I'm here. And that, to me, is just not very much. I wonder what the point is of that.
We're talking with Colin Fleming. And before we let you go, I want to bring it up because you posted about the passing last night on Facebook, of the passing of the great actor John Mahoney. So brilliant in Frasier, but so many movies, so many television shows through the years. A pro, and a lot of people may not know the story, that he was British and didn't begin his acting career until he was in his mid to late 30s.
Classic character actor, like in the way, like if you go back to a lot of those British ensembles, like those mid-century British ensembles, I wonder, like, he must have just seen so many of those as a kid, because that was kind of like the role he was sort of in. British actors in those films, they always seemed, right, like Mervyn Jones, they seemed older than they were.
It's
you look
true.
Them up on Wikipedia later, it's like, dude, you're 43. You look like you're like 64. And when you think about this, so he died, he's only 77, and Frasier premiered in 93, right? So
yeah,
he's kind of supposed to be old and a little crotchety on the show, right? But he's like awfully young when it starts out. He's not that much older, right? Can't be, than Kelsey Grammer.
Yeah, right. I would say a decade, no more than that.
And yet he had that separation. Part of it was that gravelly voice, and he had kind of those like Irish like eyes, right? That kind of. But yeah, wonderful character actor. You mentioned 8 Men Out, right? A lot of people have been posting about that today. Maybe the best baseball film of the last 30 plus years. It's been a while. I think it's like right up there.
Yeah, and
more than.
One of the more interesting father-daughter relationships in film, too, in Say Anything with Ione Skye.
Yeah, someone mentioned that to me today. And there was the type of thing, too, that I think this person who mentioned it was a father. So it seems to be something they pick up on. And, yes, people. But I always thought of that more as John Cusack thing. That was kind of his vehicle, whereas I felt that this particular actor, his real sort of meaty roles were in ensembles. I mean, 8 Men Out is such an ensemble. Like, who would you even say is the main character? Like, there kind of really isn't one, right? And he's in that position in that film of, like, kind of knowing but not knowing. And that's just a difficult kind of dichotomy to pull off. He does it on Frasier, where he's basically charming, and at the same time, he can't stand his sons, but he's very loving, too, towards them as well. So, yeah, great, great, great actor that I think a lot of people have seen in a lot of things, but might not have known him by name.
Colin Fleming here on the Best of Downtown Sunday Morning. When we come back, we'll talk with Dr. Samuel Harrington, how to prepare best for death, how to make sure that your death, family member's death, is the kind you would like it to be, and sharing your vision for the end of life. Actually, more uplifting than it sounds. After this break, you'll hear it right here on Downtown Z62 Retro Radio.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at UMaineAlumniCard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
At this busy time of year, there's nothing better than a place that offers you one-stop shopping. That place is G&M Family Market on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, of course a Dunkin' Donuts and an Amato's right on site. Stop into G&M Family Market every day of the week from 6 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and if they don't have what you're looking for, they'll make every effort to get it next time. G&M Family Market, Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 899-2552. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Penobscot Theater presents...
My name is Albert Sody, and have I got a buck story for you.
Come up to camp for a deer hunting tall tale by actor Jeff Daniels.
Takes place in the Sody Deer Camp, just north of Escanaba, Michigan. That's in the Upper Peninsula, for those of you that don't know nothing.
Escanaba in the Moonlight, February 1st through the 18th at Bangor's Historic Opera House.
There's a couple of things that need to be explained. First is, in the UP, we don't explain things.
Tickets at 942-3333 and PenobscotTheater.org.
Honey, what's all that barking in the neighborhood?
The dogs are saying something.
Let's listen closer.
You know, Green Acres Kennel Shop in Bangor is more than our home away from home. They're your pet food superstore. My owners have always trusted Green Acres Kennel Shop for the best price and selection. They carry a large variety of Nutrisource pet foods formulated with the best ingredients and made with integrity. Oh, they even have a rewards program. I save my owner's money by earning points for every purchase.
We interrupt this message to bring you the cats of the neighborhood.
Meow. It's not all about the dogs around here. Don't forget your feline friends. Green Acres Kennel Shop is my parents' pet food headquarters. They buy me the best brands of dry and canned choices.
Well, dear, the dogs and cats around here know best. Time to make Green Acres Kennel Shop our new pet food store.
Green Acres Kennel Shop, Union Street, Bangor. Online at greenacreskennel.com.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, our home away from home.
Best of Downtown Sunday Morning. Rich Kimball, Kerry Haskell.
The stars fall silent from your eyes.
R.E.M. singing about the great beyond. And we talked about that this week with author Samuel Harrington, retired doctor who lives part of the year in Stonington now. And he's written a wonderful book entitled At Peace, How to Get You or Family Members Ready for the Kind of Death You'd Like to Have. Here's Dr. Sam Harrington on the Best of Downtown. One of the points that you make throughout the book is how important it is for all of us to share our vision for the end of our life with family and friends.
Exactly. It is very uncomfortable, even for me, talking with my father, and we had a very open relationship in this regard. When we got down to the nitty-gritty, it became increasingly uncomfortable. But I think having a vision is a way of opening that conversation, because even though the vision, I mean, just a minimal expression of a vision about how one would prefer to die opens the expression, the conversation to make other points and make other decisions.
When is a good time to have these conversations?
Well, any time, but I think, people should really start throughout their life with their family and their children, when they're young adults. There's no particular time, but it does become very important when dealing with a person who's aging and will be facing rapid fire decisions as diseases progress. So starting earlier is better, but facing the important decisions later usually works out.
I thought it was a very interesting, you distinguish in the book between terminal illness, a phrase that doctors sometimes are loath to use, and a terminal condition.
Yes, I do. I think it's, and I don't think most people make that distinction, but I think it's quite possible to say to yourself or say to oneself or as a physician to look at a patient and say, all right, this diagnosis is going to be the cause of their death later. This is a terminal diagnosis. But the terminal condition comes on when that disease has progressed. So I use an example in my book of a woman who came to me, and we made a very surprised diagnosis of widespread breast cancer. And I just knew that she was going to die from this disease, whether it was in 3 years or 5 years. But we didn't think of it as, we thought of it as a terminal diagnosis, but we didn't think of it as a terminal condition until several years later when the disease had relapsed and treatments were failing.
You said, too, that doctors can sometimes be like generals and use all of the weapons at their disposal. But when that happens, too, the patients can sometimes be, for lack of a better term, the collateral damage in all of this.
Exactly. A serious complication will shorten one's life, depending on when we use aggressive treatments. But I use that analogy that doctors are like generals on a war footing, because it is completely appropriate for us to use overwhelming force when we are dealing with a disease that can be cured or a patient that is young. But when we're dealing with an elderly patient who is dying of an advanced illness plus old age, or perhaps dying simply of old age, that is not an appropriate use time to use excessive force. And that kind of excessive treatment ultimately will morph into futile treatment, and futile treatment is cruel and wrong.
Hi, Dr. Harrington. This is Kerry Haskell. I had a question sort of related to that. What is the role of the doctor in getting the patient's feedback on what type of, how aggressive, especially the older patients, how aggressive they want the treatments to be at later points in their life?
Well, I would like to think that a doctor's role is absolutely primary in that, and that it is our responsibility to sound out patients on the subject, even those patients who don't want to share it. But the fact is that most patients don't want to get into details, and it is easier for doctors to finesse that conversation than to undergo it. So it is easier to quote, offer hope by more treatment. And the path of least resistance in the United States is to treat, and ultimately to treat excessively.
We're talking with Samuel Harrington. His book is called At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. You use the story of your own mother and father to help us view this through the lens of your own personal experience. From that personal level, did that make it more difficult for you to write this story?
No, in fact, it sort of released me. I'd been struggling trying to write the story, to write the book, because I had, as a young physician, I had matured into an older physician, from a young physician who was focused on technological skills to somebody who had observed his parents age and then dwindle and die at the same time that medicine was morphing from a healing art till at the end of my career, it had become a large commercial enterprise. And during this process, I matured and came to the feeling that comfort care at the end of life, and by that I mean nursing care and support, emotional support, are more important than my technological skills. So when my father had passed away, I sat down and pounded out about 60% of the book because I knew I had something to say, and he had shown me a good deal of the way.
And for people to go home, to leave a hospital, to leave a facility and go home, it's not just going home to die. It's really, as you say, going home to take control.
I feel that's the case. Of course, going home usually or ideally will involve hospice care. And when you go home and go into hospice care, you have the opportunity to make your own decisions. You have taken the controls away from the physician and the systems that are in place in a hospital to get their best results. But those systems don't necessarily work for a given elderly individual. Whereas at home, you set up your own emotional support system. You get your own family, friends, system of caregivers, and working within the concept that hospice is an alternative medical system that protects you from that protects one from the test and treat emphasis we have in standard medical care. It's really a protective process.
Yeah, and as you point out, hospice is a way of avoiding that excessive care.
Exactly. Hospices have a supply equipment and medication, et cetera, at home with a forward-looking approach, anticipating problems, supplying a mattress to prevent bed sores, for example, supplying oxygen for the potential of becoming short of breath, so that when something occurs at home, you don't have to call 911 and get, in a sense, carted off to an emergency room. You have hospice people to call on, and they can tell you what to do with the medications you have in your house while they organize more help and a potential visit to analyze your situation.
From your years dealing with patients at the end of their life, do you find that there are some pretty common themes about how people would like their life to end?
Well, actually, I think everybody's vision is very individual. My father's vision, for example, was to let an aortic aneurysm rupture. Well, that's an extremely painful situation, but death is quick and certain if you decline emergency surgery and take palliative medication, pain medication, which was his plan. So that's very few people would embrace that particular vision. But the vision of dying at home or dying in one's sleep is quite common. Visions are individual. Mm. But where it's been studied and dissected, the attributes of a good death include these five components. One, control is the most important. Then comfort, closure, meaning the opportunity to reconcile with family and friends. Affirmation, meaning having your ideals and values appreciated. And trust, meaning you've surrounded yourself with a comfortable environment. And so if you can, those can form a common understanding of what a good death is, or at least a better death. And if you flip those and think of helplessness, isolation, frustration, and denial, that pretty much describes what death is like in an intensive care unit.
That's Dr. Samuel Harrington talking about his book, At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. When we come back, we'll talk Red Sox. What are they doing this offseason? Short answer, not much. Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal next on Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
Your home should be your sanctuary, the place that keeps you safe and warm in the winter and cool and dry in the summer. The people at Penobscot Home Performance want to make sure your home is safe, healthy, comfortable, and energy efficient. They take a big picture view with practical steps and use their experience to ensure that the space and systems in your house are working better together. Contact them today for a free energy consultation by visiting PenobscotHomePerformance.com. Red Sox open camp, pitchers and catchers ready to report this week, but not a whole lot of movement on that roster. Will they or won't they sign J.D. Martinez? That and several other questions we put to Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal, who joined us earlier this week here on Downtown.
To think that we are less than a week away from pitchers and catchers reporting. They report next Tuesday, and first workout, I guess, is Wednesday. To think that this roster is really unchanged from where it was, say, on July 31st or July 30th. Well, I guess it was 31st because for a change last year, the because of the way the calendar fell, the trade deadline was August 1st, and they made some moves leading up to that with Nunez and Addison Reed. But this is essentially the very same roster that existed in mid-July last year, right down to bringing Mitch Moreland back. And while that's not a terrible collection of talent, it's not an improvement at a time when other teams in the division have improved, notably the Yankees.
A lot of discussion this week about what J.D. Martinez may or may not have said. Scott Boras went public and said, no, we're still in the middle of good faith negotiations. Couple reports today that the Diamondbacks may up the ante. Are the Red Sox still pursuing J.D. Martinez as their top target?
Well, I guess that would depend on your definition of pursuing. There is the offer of 5 and 125 or thereabouts on the table that obviously both J.D. Martinez and Scott Boras have deemed insufficient at this point. I think if they were to call Dave Dombrowski right now and say, we'll take it, I'm sure that they could get a deal done. And in fact, I think there's probably a little wiggle room, whether it means some language that would result in the vesting of a sixth year or a slight tweak of the money over the 5 years. But I think you can understand the Red Sox stance on this at this point, that whether or not Arizona is in and in as far as the Red Sox are, I've seen wildly different depictions of where the Diamondbacks are. Some people have written that their deal is nearly identical to that of the Red Sox. Others have said it's a one-year deal. So that's a pretty big spread, obviously, if you're talking, you know, 20-something million for one or 5 years and $125 million. There's a lot of space in between those two. But we've heard in the past that the Diamondbacks probably couldn't afford to, you know, go toe-to-toe with some other teams on Martinez because of the Zach Greinke contract that they continue to carry and the fact that their best player, Paul Goldschmidt, is going to be eligible for free agency after 2019, and they've got to figure out a way to lock him up. So I know that Martinez had a huge impact on them when he came over in June or July, and the power numbers he had in Phoenix in their home ballpark. But I find it hard to believe that they're willing to make that sort of multi-year commitment to him. So, again, the Red Sox are left asking themselves, with good reason, why should we bid against ourselves when it seems like we have the best offer on the table now? If that's not good enough, why do we need to add to it and essentially bid against ourselves?
So if this doesn't work out, do they have a plan B?
Well, you may have seen Dave Dombrowski's comments to Ken Rosenthal in The Athletic earlier in the week, in which, you know, he still thinks there's going to be a reckoning here, whether it comes in February or maybe in March, where some of these guys decide that, you know, 80 cents on the dollar or however you want to term some of these offers is better than nothing. And he also made the interesting point that with the free agent market so stagnant, there's been more trade talk of late with teams sort of restarting some deals and talks about things that didn't get done earlier in the winter. There was even the report yesterday that maybe Cleveland and the Red Sox had talked about a Jackie Bradley Jr. for Edwin Encarnacion deal. I'm told by a source that was overstated, that while it may have been put on the table, it never really got a lot of traction. And when you think about it from Cleveland's standpoint, they've already lost Carlos Santana to Philadelphia. This would be losing a second power bat in the same offseason, three, if you count Jay Bruce, who they didn't retain after getting him from the Mets in August. And they also have a young first-round pick from 2014, Bradley Zimmer, that they feel pretty good about as their future center fielder. He's not Jackie Bradley Jr. defensively, but he's a pretty good young player that they can control for a number of years. And then from the Red Sox standpoint, if they move Bradley and get Encarnacion to be their DH or first baseman, okay, you move Benintendi over to center. What are you doing left field? I don't think you want to put Hanley Ramirez back there. That's probably not going to fly after what happened in 2015. So that would seem to create another opening and another hole for the Red Sox. So I'm not sure that one has a lot of legs.
We're talking with Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal. And well, this weird offseason has led, as you wrote, to some tension between the commissioner's office and the Major League Baseball Players Association.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that we're just a little more than a year into this new CBA because, you know, the saber rattling and posturing on both sides sounds like it used to when we were getting toward the end of a collective bargaining agreement and teams were, or, you know, either side was sort of sending up flares about what they'd be looking for in a new deal. I think it's pretty obvious that the union now wishes that it hadn't agreed to some of the components, which has essentially encouraged teams to watch their spending and not go as heavy on some free agents as they have in the past. There are real repercussions now beyond the luxury tax penalties, and those include dropping draft position and forfeiting international pool money if you go too high over the various luxury tax thresholds. And that has had a chilling effect, obviously, on the free agent market to the point where you have some players and agents saying that there's collusion. And ordinarily, I think, you know, there may be something to that. But I think, as Rob Manfred pointed out, how can it be collusion when some teams have offers of nine figures out that just haven't been accepted. You know, Yu Darvish has supposedly got a number of deals that are in the nine-figure department. That is $100 million or more. We know that Martinez has one, that Eric Hosmer has a couple. So it's pretty hard to cry collusion when there are all these eight- and nine-figure deals that out there that the agents and players, for whatever reason, haven't accepted. I think there's a number of reasons for the slowdown. I think they've all been sort of cited elsewhere. I don't really need to go over them. You've got a big free agent class next year. You've got the additional penalties that come with going over the threshold. You've got the fact that Otani and Stanton sort of slowed everything down at the beginning of the free agent market. And now you have so many teams evaluating players the same way with analytics and realizing that free agency is not a very efficient way to build a roster.
2 weeks from today, the Red Sox play their first spring training game. It's hard to believe we're back at it. What questions are there, obviously, beyond whether or not they can sign Martinez or a bat? Are there any other big questions they have to answer in preseason this year?
Well, I think there's a lot of health issues. You've got 40%, or depending on how you count, two starters coming back from knee surgeries. Steven Wright, who had his done last summer and is much farther along, and also Eduardo Rodriguez, who had his in October. So you've got some questions with the starting rotation. You've got questions about Dustin Pedroia and how he recovers from his knee surgery and how quickly he'll be back. And then Hanley Ramirez's shoulder issues and the surgery he went under. So there's four. You know, the right side of your infield, or at least two very important parts of your lineup in Ramirez and Pedroia, and two of your five or six starters who are coming off surgeries. So that's one thing. I think there's the question of, you know, some of the guys that had off years at the plate, be it Bogarts or Bradley, how much do they bounce back? And I think questions about, you know, Alex Cora being a rookie manager in an unforgiving market like Boston. By all accounts, he's a good communicator. He's played here as a player for 4 years, so he knows what's expected. But it's still his first rodeo here, and it'll be interesting to see how he handles the pressure and demands of the job. So while I still think this is a pretty talented roster, one good enough to compete for a playoff spot, they are not without their questions, and that's even independent, as you said, of whether they add to it with a bat between now and opening day.
Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal here, wrapping up the Best of Downtown for a Sunday morning. Thanks to Sean, Dr. Samuel Harrington, Colin Fleming, and Molly McHugh, and thanks to you for making us a part of your Sunday. Stick around, great music from the 60s and 70s all day long, and then we're back doing our thing on a Monday afternoon. More baseball talk tomorrow. Ted Berg of USA Today lands in Florida and then gets on the phone with us to let us know what's happening down there as spring training camps get set to open this week. Nick Durba, Maine baseball, just a couple of days from the start of their spring trip. We'll catch up with him. Plus, Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald, Alan Adams of the Maine Edge with movie reviews on Pass the Popcorn, and another retro rock conversation, this time with Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. All coming up tomorrow afternoon at 4, right here on Downtown. Have a great rest of your Sunday. A fine part of your weekend, whatever remains, and we'll see you tomorrow at 4 for Downtown here on Z62 Retro Radio. You're gonna